We are back with Daniel J. Duke, the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. Daniel, talk to me about your great-great-grandfather's use of templates with these maps. First of all, you know, what are templates, and what did they have to do with the treasure?
Okay. First of all, I believe it was a Knights of the Golden Circle template in the beginning, because that had been online. Anybody who spoke about the Knights of the Golden Circle, there were usually copies of the template involved with any of the treasure legends in books and online. Well, I found tracing the template and where it came from led to J. Frank Dalton. He had claimed, after my grandfather had died in 1943, or great-great-grandfather, after Jesse died in 1943, Dalton, in 1948, came out claiming that he was Jesse. Before that, my great-grandmother had been living, who was Jesse's daughter, had been living in Marble Falls, Texas, and she had a lot of her father's papers, Jesse's papers and other things. J. Frank Dalton was staying in the Roper Hotel in Marble Falls, Texas, right across the street from my great-grandmother. Somehow, I believe, in that little time frame, while he was at the hotel across the street from her, and they had met several times, also when he was in a hospital in Austin once, but I believe he got a lot of his information from my great-grandmother, including the template. So tracing that down, I believe, you know, I found out, I believe the template came from my grandfather, knowing that he was in the Masons, after he had faked his death, he was living as a peaceful farmer here in Texas, and that's when he joined the Freemasons. I think he employed a lot of their symbols, and I think that's where the template originated.
When we say template, what we mean is like a grid system, because it's important for people to understand that if you've got treasure scattered all over Oklahoma and Texas and Missouri and other places, and you draw a map leading to it, the topography is going to change over time. There'll be floods, there'll be forest fires, there'll be construction. And you'll never be able, or those people that come after you, if you're hoping your progeny and so forth will find the treasure, they'll never find it unless you use this grid system, which is the template, right?
Exactly. It's just like laying out a city. You're going to have a grid system, you're going to have vacant lots, buildings. In the treasure template, there's a lot more vacant lots than there would be, you know, treasure, because it covers the Americas, Mexico, United States, and Canada. But you're exactly right. It's a grid system, and I call it the veil template. Before I realized it was a Freemasonic template, it was known as the KGC template.
What makes it a Masonic template? It's just a grid, after all. So what makes it a Masonic grid?
That's a good question. I wanted to know, after I found out the scale of the template, and I found out that it was actually the KGC template, which is a rhombus with two circles inside it and a lot of little symbols, like what they call turkey tracks and other symbols, little dots and squares. Well, I found out that was just one cell of the entire grid, like a city block, if you wanted to compare it to a grid system for a city. And it covers the Americas. I wanted to know, first of all, that it lined up with historic sites across America, and it also lined up with known treasure sites that were known to have items that predated the Knights of the Golden Circle. And I thought, wait a minute, I thought this was a Knights of the Golden Circle template. They weren't around several centuries before the Civil War. So who put this there? And slowly, over the years, I would piece together bits of information while reading the works of Albert Pike, Manly Palmer Hall, and other Freemasons. Things started falling into line, and it led me to Kabbalah, Freemasons, the symbols used in the maps, the distances, the geometric shapes, and the distances between treasure sites and on the templates all line up with, and they have meaning when applied to Christian, Jewish, and occult Kabbalah and other beliefs. They all have meanings. It's astrological definitions and all kinds of other meanings that tie in with that. Male, female, the meeting, the joining of male and female, the earth and the celestial, terrestrial and celestial, you know, just all kinds of deep symbols and deep meanings. And one thing I loved about that, while reading Albert Pike, he was talking about symbols and how the basically the beauty of symbols is they have, they often have more than one meaning. So, and this is full of multiple meanings. It was amazing. It's basically reading through Albert Pike's works, Manly Palmer Hall's and others, I tied in the template, the dimensions, the signatures were in the numbers, and it all tied in with Freemasonry and back past the Founding Fathers to Francis Bacon, John Dee, and all the way back to the Templar.
So if I'm understanding and following this correctly, it sounds like your great-great-granddad, Jesse James, he hid some treasure, a bunch of it, all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then he incorporated his treasure map into an already existing map that had been designed by people who had visited North America before the founding of the country.
Exactly.
And buried their treasure all over the place. Is
exactly.
that, do I have it right?
You do. You have
and
it right.
And so when we talk about buried treasure that was placed in the United States prior to the founding of the United States, and you mentioned Sir Francis Bacon, are we talking about the Knights Templar here?
Yes. And at first, you know, I wanted to trace not only the template, and there's two templates. There's a Tree of Life template, and the Veil template covers the Tree of Life template, which falls in line perfect, beautifully with Kabbalah. I mean, it was the whole thing is laid out very beautifully. And but I wanted to trace back, you know, I wanted to find out who did it, why, and when, you know, and what did they bury. And it was much more than just gold, I believe. It's also items of spiritual significance, which ties back to the Templar and the Dome of the Rock, you know, Solomon's Temple, all that kind of stuff.
You believe that's all in the United States?
I don't believe it's all in the U.S., but I believe a lot of it is here.
And how did Jesse James get his hands on these map, these Templar, these ancient Templar maps? Well, they're not ancient, but they're certainly pretty old.
That's a real good question, and I've got a lot of theories on that, but I have no proof. And when it comes to secrets of that nature, it's very hard to find any kind of proof. On where, you know, when he came into contact with this. It may have been passed down through his family. They were a well-to-do family. They were educated. They have ties back, you know, deep ties in the founding of the U.S. and also with in England. It could have passed down through his family, or it could have been through someone he met on, you know, during the Civil War or after the Civil War. There's a lot of questions on that I hope to find answers to, but there's a lot of mystery still involved in that.
And let's say, for example, the legend of Oak Island up here in Canada off the coast of Nova Scotia. Some have theorized that the treasure that's at the bottom of the money pit, the infamous money pit, is Templar treasure. Does Oak Island appear on any of your great-great-granddad's maps?
On the Veil template that covers the Americas, the Oak Island and the area around it are on the map. Things like not just Oak Island, but the Newport Tower, the Los Lunas Decalogue Stone in New Mexico, and other areas, the Kensington Runestone that Scott Walter of the Hooked X is also located very near to the template. It amazes me at how many historic sites that also involve a lot of mystery are located on the template. And I don't think it was all Jesse. He was a very important, he was an important part of it, but he was a small, very small part of the big picture.
And so, but he believed he was continuing in the tradition of the Knights Templar by burying treasure, using the same template. So, what was it? What was it all about? What was the big picture? Who did he want to find the treasure? What was it supposed to be used for?
I believe one quote from Timothy Hogan, who is the Templar Grand Master. He's also an author and lecturer. He had stated that Daniel J. Duke has successfully cracked open part of the mystery surrounding the Templar treasure from Jerusalem that had been moved to the Americas to help establish a free nation. That first part of his endorsement that's on my book, is that says a lot of it, says it all pretty much, in a broad statement, that's why they wanted to form a free nation. And it was, when you trace it back through all the people involved, it was like a family tree. When I was tracing it back, it was almost as if you're tracing an organization, or much in the same way you would do a family tree. You know, Jesse was a Freemason, and it goes back to Albert Pike, you know, all the way to the founding fathers, and people like Thomas Jefferson. His mentor was a man by the name of William Small. William Small was well-versed. He was an Enlightenment student born in Scotland who was well-versed. He introduced Thomas Jefferson to the writings of Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, John Locke, who was his mentor. And it just goes back to Francis Bacon. When I found that, I thought, aha, I found the guy who started it all. At the beginning, I didn't know the Templar were involved. And then, after a while, researching more, reading more, everything I could get my hands on, I learned that John Dee was the mentor of Francis Bacon. He was a well-known alchemist. He was also known as the original 007. I mean, this guy, he was an amazing man. He ties into Leonardo da Vinci. Hieropoulos, Johann Ruplin, all the way back to Paolo Riccio, who was a Jewish convert to Christianity, and I don't know if he converted willingly, or if he had a choice, you know, convert or die. But he had written a book in 1516, which had a hidden map on it that also furthered my discovery with the Tree of Life. It added a lot more evidence. There's even a drawing of the hooked X on the front of that book. And that was a translation of Abraham Gitatilla's work, who was a Jewish rabbi, traced all the way back through different rabbis, some related by blood, others by marriage, but it's a clear line all the way back to a rabbi known as Rashi, a famous Jewish rabbi. He was a favored court guest in the court of Hugh, the Count of Champagne, who was one of the founders of the Templar.
So the idea was that a lot of the Templar treasures, some of it was from Solomon's Temple, maybe some of it was from Herod's Temple, that was all to be, not all of it, but a great deal of it was to be shipped over to the United States.
Yes.
Or the colonies back then, and because the Templars were on the run. They were being persecuted themselves.
Exactly.
By the church.
And see, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. I'm just trying to follow along here.
Oh, yeah. And all these groups, you know, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, they were living in a time where scientific discoveries, new discoveries. If you said the wrong thing publicly, you could literally either lose everything you had or lose your life. So, you know, there's an oppression that they were living under. Then when you go back further to the other people involved, like there were Jewish rabbis, it even ties back to people in Islam or Muslims from the Druze tradition and Sufi mystics. The Templar Grand Master Timothy Hogan had mentioned that the Templar went, that before the Crusades, a lot of people lump the Templar in with the Crusaders, but that isn't so. They went into the Middle East before the Crusades with the goal of preserving knowledge, sacred artifacts and things of that, and documents and things of that nature, and that's a lot of the treasure they got, including the treasures at the temple in Jerusalem. But
so
all these people had been persecuted, different groups of the people involved persecuted throughout history at different times in history. The Templar were even persecuted after 1307, and they all had a dream of a place, you know, when the New World was known, they had a dream for a place where they could all live in harmony without the fear of losing their heads,
right,
and being, you know, and all the persecution.
So, but it's hard for me to imagine that a young Jesse James, while he's holding up trains, has this big picture view that this is where all this treasure is going to go. That he's playing a part in this Knights Templar plot to form a new country.
Exactly. It's it sounded when I first stumbled onto this. You know, I was looking for Jesse's treasure in the beginning, and when I stumbled onto all this, I thought, okay, either I've gone insane or I have found one of the biggest treasure stories in U.S. if not world history. It's amazing, and it all ties in perfectly. So Jesse, I don't know when he became a part of that exactly, but I know definitely he buried his treasures on the template that lines up with all the other treasures that are known. So he knew about it, and he was a part of it. I believe there's a lot of theories. One theory that makes a lot of sense to me is they may have been in the KGC during the Civil War, or they may have known. Surely they knew about the KGC. So maybe they knew where some of the treasures were, got information on that, and relocated them. Took the treasures from the KGC if they were actually hoarding treasures as it was said they did.
So how many maps?
Some of that they could have taken from them, and maybe that's when he became, you know, maybe that's when he learned of all that.
How many maps did your great-great-grandfather leave? Do we know?
He had several maps. I know we have one copy of the map. There were other maps. There were several maps. There was another map a partial map in one of his letters. And then, you know, there's the map that George Roeming had drawn for my mother and I. So there's three sure maps that we have.
And how many caches of hidden gold are there, do you suspect?
Oh, I believe there's hundreds.
Hundreds?
I think a lot of them fall into small caches. They're part of the Veil template. And a lot of those are small, maybe a jar of coins. Those are the ones that were set or placed in more modern times. I also believe there are some large ones still out there, but I also think they're protected, and I'm glad they are.
And we're just about to the bottom of the hour here. We're going to break here momentarily. But that big cache that you mentioned, this young fellow had helped your great-grandfather bury, 650 gold bars, 15 pounds each.
Yeah, it was 680.
680 bars. Where is that? I mean, have you located that?
I know where it's at, but it's on inside the Fort Hood Military Reservation, just outside of Killeen, Texas, near Lake Belton.
All right, we'll pick up on that point when we come back. Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. Here's the band, Time to Kill, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Daniel J. Duke, author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. And I'm sure you've heard this countless times, but it all sounds like a scene right out of the Nicolas Cage movie National Treasure, with hidden Templar treasure and so forth. The thing that I'd be curious to know is, there must be a number of these copies of these maps floating around within your family. I mean, are there factions within your family? I don't want to open up, you know, old wounds here or anything, but are there battles going on that some, you know, that you're competing to find this treasure? Is it a race to find the treasure?
I don't believe it's a race to find the treasure. I'm sure there are others who are looking, but, one thing, when you mentioned the National Treasure movie, that's exactly what I've been saying. It reminds me of a mix of the Da Vinci Code, and it's like the Da Vinci Code meets National Treasure. It's an amazing story. The factions in the family, there were some, you know, some were from the older generation. They recently passed away within the last decade or so, but they. Some of them were ashamed to publicly mention that they were related to an outlaw. And like one lady, for example, she was a very nice lady. Her name was May. She was one of the grandchildren of Jesse. She burned over 200 letters. So, and to me, that's almost criminal. You know, that was burning history. So that scared me when I found that. I thought, you know, how do you... I hope nobody else does anything like this, because there could have been a lot of valuable information in there, historical and other information, you know, just for the family, too. So, but yes, when we have some that wanted to keep it quiet, they didn't like that my mother came out with it. There was one who had been working on the same story, and I believe when my mother came out with it, he kind of got mad because I guess it stole his thunder. He should have said something instead of being so secretive about it. She would have been more than happy to have worked with it. But, you know, there's little things like that that have gone on through the family for years. But most of the family believes it. They all know it. They know the story. Some just didn't want to admit it for a while.
Was there ever any consideration given to exhuming your great-granddad and doing a DNA test?
Yes, we wanted to. And I can't remember the exact date of that. My mother went to court in Falls County, Texas, to get in her attempt to exhume the body and have DNA testing. And it didn't require digging up the grave or even opening it. All that needed to be done was to bore a small hole down into the grave and retrieve a dime-sized piece of bone. That's all that needs to be done. Well, they got, you know, the ones that wanted to keep it quiet, that half of the family, they fought it tooth and nail, and we were denied. My mother was denied the order, or she was denied permission to do this, to do the exhumation, but unless she could find more information later, that would bolster, you know, her argument. And she had enough then in most people's eyes, but between that time and when she passed away in 2015, she had found a lot more information. So more than enough to go through with it.
And what do you believe Jesse James's wishes were for the goal? Not to be left in the ground. I mean, it was to serve the United States, right? Was it to be put in the U.S. Treasury to pay off the debt?
I'm not sure as toward what the current use for it would be. I know that, as Timothy Hogan had stated, it was used to help form a free nation. I think it may be used to bail us out. I don't know. At certain times or in times of, you know, horrible trouble, it could be used to preserve our freedoms and liberties. I don't know. That's a good question. There's a lot of answers. There are a lot of questions I have that I would love answers to. But I believe everything they've done has been to protect the United States and keep it, their whole goal, original goal, a free nation.
I've got my the calculator out on my phone. I wanted to get an answer to the amount, the 680 gold bars, each weighing 15 pounds. At 16 ounces times roughly $1,400 an ounce. It's just astronomical, that amount.
Yeah, it's a huge number. And that's that was just one spot.
2.2848 e to the power of 9, I guess. I don't know how you read that. Anyway.
Yeah.
And that's buried under Fort Hood somewhere.
Yes, or it was. It may have been recovered. I know it was under... The location where it was buried is now under Lake Belton. I believe personally that it was probably recovered and moved to either used or moved to another location.
All right. Let's say hi to, Steve is a first-time caller in South Carolina. Steve, good morning. Welcome to Coaster on the Line with Daniel J. Duke.
Hi, Steve. Good morning, Richard. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Duke, through my family history, supposedly there's a story that there was an uncle or a cousin that didn't want to be associated, you know, with the James gang and what was going on and stuff, and it changed their first and last name and switched them from Irvin James to James Irvin. Through your search and your mother's search, has there been anything that you've found out about that?
I don't recall that off the top of my head, but that's a good question, and I'm writing it down right now just to look for it. We've done a lot of, my mother had done a lot of genealogy, and some friends of hers had done a lot. So if his name may be in one of our family trees.
No, you know, this is well back before the internet and everything, and we had a lot of pictures hanging in our hallway of our farmhouse in Arizona. That, you know, we lost to a fire back in just before Christmas of 85. And a lot of these pictures were supposedly of Jesse, of Irvin, of, you know, that through that family and everything else. And of course, you know, we lost those. I know if you Google it now, you can actually read a story supposedly about this uncle that, you know, wanted to not be associated with the bad side of the family, so to speak.
Yeah.
And changed his name.
That could very well be. That would go along with, you know, what I had mentioned, some of the older relatives on another side of our family who didn't want to recognize that, and they definitely wouldn't have said it publicly.
Right. So. That's exactly right. Yes. Steve, thank you for that. Appreciate the call. Let's see. Wild card line again. Frank is in Hollywood, Florida. Frank, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hollywood, Maryland.
Hollywood, Maryland. My apologies. Well, welcome nonetheless. Good to have you aboard.
You answered most of my questions, but Jesse James, as a younger man, when he joined Quantrill and later on Buddy Bill Anderson, did he know what he was getting into? These Kansas Raiders, I got some really, really bad stories about them. And then he talks about finding a new nation, a free nation. I hope that didn't include slavery, which they were fighting for. And that ill-fated bank robbery in Minnesota with Cole Younger. Did Cole Younger's younger brother die in that raid? And what went wrong with that raid?
Okay. Well, first of all, with the free nation, and that's a good question. Thanks for asking them. When you mentioned the free nation and slavery, I believe at the time, in those days, slavery was a common, unfortunately, it was very common for, you know, well before the founding of the U.S. I think their goal was to get the nation formed and then work on all the problems so that everyone could be free. That's my belief in that. You know, you couldn't change everything at once. You had to do it in steps. Form the nation, make sure it's free, set down the laws, the Constitution, everything you needed to have a free nation, and then work on everything else. Unfortunately, the goal of ending slavery turned into a huge bloody war, but that, you know, that, as Benjamin Franklin is quoted as saying by many, you know, sometimes the tree of liberty needs to be fed with the blood of patriots and tyrants alike. So I hope that answers that part. As for Minnesota and Northfield, the robbery that went bad, I believe Wood Height was there and not Jesse. Yeah, according to Jesse's, all the information we have on Jesse, his diary and everything else, he was here in Texas, and he wasn't at that robbery. So, but Frank Frank was there, and he had some wounds, got shot in his leg, and he went to a doctor in Waco. There's a lot of proof to back that up also with old records and newspaper articles. But Frank made it to Waco, and Jesse met him in Waco, and then I believe he spent a lot of time or a while healing at Jesse's farm in Blevins.
Frank, thank you for the call. Great questions. Let's say hi to Walt in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Walt, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for your beautiful voice, buddy.
Thank you, my friend.
Richard, I remember seeing a photograph of Jesse James where he's carrying a Remington revolver as opposed to normally, you know, the old West characters would be carrying a Colt revolver. Now, it's easy at a glance to tell the difference between the Remington and the Colt revolver because the Remington incorporated a top strap, which made it much stronger than the Colt. It made the frame much more rigid, and at a glance, it's easy to tell. So I'd just like to say that, you know, if they could, this great-great-grandson of Jesse could locate that iconic Remington revolver, it would be worth much more than its weight in gold.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Go ahead, Daniel. Did you want to respond?
It would be worth a lot of money. I think it would belong in a museum instead of being sold to a private collector. My wish is for all the relics that belonged to Jesse and his family to be in one museum preserved and not auctioned off and sold to people, which has been done in many cases throughout the years, unfortunately. But he had a lot of guns. He went through a lot of guns. There's one gun that we know of that he had with his initials and another man's known gang member's initials carved inside the handle. And I would love to get it, but I can't afford it right now. So hopefully,
all right, well,
hopefully one day I'll be able to get my hands on that one and put it in a museum.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's say hi to Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, you do a great job with your interview. And I would like to point out that with the questions of this, is if it's really his Jesse that lived, if you'll explain in the book how he lived so long that your very uncle sat on Jesse's lap as an infant, and things about why he was willing to be buried under that name he lived under at 70, something about it's good enough to live by, it's good enough to die by. He said that's the name he wanted, right?
That's right.
And don't you have some of the bones and have some potential DNA, your mom and so forth, with another known relative that they're working on? And also about the church in 1715 and the 1,715 miles to out west and the 1,715 feet or yards, whatever, to the first building at William and Mary, some of those things.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he lived till 1943. My uncle was born before that. He died in 1943. My uncle Wayne Dorsett was born before he died, and he held my uncle on his lap. My uncle was so young, he didn't remember it, but he did hold him on his lap. Everybody else in the family remembered it. Let's see, what was the next question? Oh, he told one of his friends, and you got to remember again, back in those times, things were different. He didn't want all the notoriety that would befall his family. You know, if everybody had known that he was Jesse James at that time, the notoriety that would have fallen on his children. And he knew how they felt, and he knew how they were raised. It wouldn't have looked good publicly on his children. He also said a name to live by is a name to die by. That was the only reason he gave. So any other reason I have would be just conjecture. 1715. It's 1,715 miles from the Bruton Parish Church, where the vault is supposedly located. And I believe it is, because all the proof that Maria Bauer Hall had discovered on everything else with the code she decrypted show that, I mean, she's proven herself right in so many cases. The vault is the only other thing that she wanted to dig
and
up,
which,
and I believe it's there.
Which treasure is that you're referring to, Daniel, the vault?
The one in Williamsburg, Virginia, and it's known as the Bruton Parish Vault, or the Bruton Vault. It's in the cemetery of the Bruton Parish Church in Williamsburg. That church is 1,715 feet, according to Google Earth, from the location of where the vault should be to the College of William and Mary, the Christopher Wren building. And Christopher Wren was a part of this also. He was also a Freemason. It's also 1,715 miles from exactly to Victoria Peak, where that treasure was discovered in New Mexico. And that's the middle pillar of the Tree of Life template, which, according to Gematria, the Kabbalistic Gematria, can be translated as behold the Tree of Life. That would be the center pillar. And another clue on that, the center pillar, it represents the joining of, or it's the balance or harmony between the male and the female sides. And it starts at the College of William and Mary, they were king and queen of England at the time, and they were co-rulers. They were ruling together, which, you know, that's just a male and female, that line, their name, everything about it just ties in perfectly.
Has the treasure from the vault been discovered, retrieved?
I don't know. I believe it probably has been, but that I have no facts on that. That kind of... It may still be there. It may be the perfect place to protect it because it's a tourist attraction, and any excavation would be known right away. So it could be there, or it may have been moved or retrieved.
As a result of this book, Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure and the work your mother did. Any, do you think that this is going to set the record straight and change the history books?
I believe it will. And my sister and I have co-authored another book that's going to come out. It should be in our publisher's catalog in September, which is dealing just with Jesse and the continuation of our mother's work on Jesse. I think everything we have, the last thing it takes is DNA. We've proven that their DNA, their exhumation in 1995 proved nothing. We've got a lot of proof on that. And we have known DNA from a direct line from Zerelda, Jesse's mother, to Sue Laura Hale, who lived in California. She donated her blood, and it was taken by a doctor, sent through strict chain of custody to a DNA forensic expert that we have here in Texas. And it's just we've got several steps to go through, but we're well on the way.
Excellent. All right. And Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, available at Amazon and wherever good books are sold. Thank you so much for this, Daniel.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
A real pleasure. All right. Thank you. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Michael Cozio, Anna Ramirez, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, Sean Latticeur, and here in Toronto, Greg Bishop, let's not forget Greg, and here in Toronto, Mike Van Dixon and Patrick O'Neill, and in Brantford, Scott Guitar Flicks. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. I'm going to take a little time off, get some R&R. Back in September, I hope, if you'll have me. So long for now.